From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
On some level, I knew that I was heading down a disastrous path, but I tried to keep that behavior as secret from my friends as long as I could.
Today, taboos. Journalist Ruben Castañeda talks about hiding his crack addiction while working at the Washington Post, and the topics you might want to avoid at the dinner table, like money.
But then I get to college and I discover you don't have to steal, you can get a credit card.
Author Daisy Hernandez on the D word, debt and Latinos, plus addressing race in the classroom, and hip-hop legend DMC visits our newsroom to talk about his first love, and it's not what you think. All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No se vayan. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. In September, the disappearance of 43 student teachers in the Mexican state of Guerrero brought up one of the biggest open secrets in Mexico, government collusion with the cartels. Since then, protests have erupted all over Mexico, and now here in the U.S. as well, on campuses and in the streets, blowing a taboo topic wide open. Baja California, the Mexican state just south of California, is usually removed from political uprisings. But inspired by the students' disappearances, people are speaking out and acknowledging problems in their own area of Mexico. Brooke Binkowski reports.
Mexicans were shocked when police in Guerrero State arrested 43 student teachers from the town of Ayotzinapa and reportedly handed them over to a local cartel. The shock became rage when the police said they were acting on the orders of a local mayor. Search parties have discovered more than a dozen mass graves in the area, but not the students. Their disappearances triggered waves of protests, including here in Baja California. Tony Rojas is one of thousands of people who have been marching on the streets in Tijuana, Baja's largest city.
We're protesting against Mexican government's politics, which in this case was the kidnap of 43 students that were studying to be professors. We're asking for the government to present the 43 people that they took and present them alive and well.
Rojas and the others are demonstrating not only to show support for the Guerrero students, they're also demanding more transparency from the federal government and drawing attention to Baja's own record of human rights abuses. These demonstrations aren't the norm here. Baja California is geographically and historically set apart from the rest of Mexico. It doesn't have much tradition of political activism. But Baja citizens have become so frustrated by the government's lack of response to violent crime and disappearances that they finally started taking matters into their own hands.
My son is with God in this moment, and he knows about me, and I know about him.
Fernando Osegueda is sitting by his tent outside Tijuana's government building, the Palacio Municipal. Across from him, sheets and handkerchiefs embroidered with the names of vanished or murdered people flutter in the Santa Ana winds. Green thread for the disappeared. Red thread for the murdered. Osegueda's been camped out here for days representing his group, waiting for the state's new governor to speak to him.
We have a meeting with my people, 250 people, and they together take decision to come to the display, the city hall, to put the pressure on the government to try to find the missing person.
Osegueda's group is called the Association for the Disappeared People in Baja California. He founded it after gunmen raided his home and took his son. He says the police refused to help and gave his family their typical excuse.
The government said, we tried to find, but your family maybe is involved in the criminal organization. Is it, well, it's not a reason to try to find the people.
According to the Mexican government's own numbers, between 1,100 and 1,200 people are officially missing in Baja California. José Guerra's efforts have pressured the government into finding the remains of some missing people and at least one mass grave in Tijuana. Activists say the problem has gotten worse in recent years, partly because of U.S. involvement in the fight against organized crime in Mexico.
This is an imposition by the United States, and Mexico is part of its focus.
That's Raúl Ramírez Baena. He's director of the Citizens Commission on Human Rights of Northeast Baja California in Mexicali, the state capital. Since 2008, under a plan called the Merida Initiative, the U.S. appropriated more than $2 billion to Mexico for police and military training to combat crime. The program is also supposed to strengthen respect for human rights. But critics like Ramirez Baena say it's actually had the opposite effect.
Forma parte de toda esta política antidrogas bajo un concepto militar.
The plan takes a military approach to the war on drugs, he says. It's pushed things to a point where there's now a crisis of impunity in Mexico. Ramirez Baena says the military in Baja California has tried to crack down on drug cartels by violating human rights, foregoing the presumption of innocence and using beatings and torture to extract confessions, whether or not the suspects are guilty. The government is well acquainted with these charges, as well as the concerns about disappearances. It offers a boilerplate response to the protests. Spokesman Teodoro Barraza.
The Association for the Disappeared did a sit-in here at the government seat last week. We spoke with them, and they brought a list of points that they agreed should be taken so that we could follow up on those disappeared people.
Afterwards, Barraza jokes in English about what he just said.
Mostly lies.
Escucha, queremos tu renuncia. Escucha, queremos tu renuncia.
Recently, the Mexican government created a database storing the genetic information of missing women and children. It took 7 years. Protester Fernando Osegueda says he's not sure how much real change is possible, but he would like to see a new Mexico.
I like that. It's a good idea. I prefer that and start again for the future, for my family, for my parents, for my brother, for my sister, and for my neighborhood, whatever. I like that.
It's too late for Osegueda's son, but the aftermath of the missing students in Guerrero has given people like Osegueda the courage to step out of the shadows. That has already changed Mexico's narrative. For Latino USA, I'm Brooke Binkowski in Tijuana, Mexico.
In the region of Cañar, deep in the Ecuadorian Andes, people have been migrating north for more than 4 decades. Many Ecuadorians see Cañar as a place full of poverty and broken families. But the benefits of migrating can be higher than the costs, especially for the women who stay home. Some become breadwinners and take on roles previously closed off to them. Ruxandra Guidi has our story from Ecuador.
On a chilly afternoon, children play in one of the picturesque plazas in the village of Cañar. You can't tell at first, but this village and the surrounding region is largely empty. Cañar sends a higher proportion of migrants abroad than any other district in Ecuador. Here, migration is practically a rite of passage. Barbarita Pichasaca knows this firsthand.
I'm also one of the migrants. We have crossed borders, we have walked and gotten ourselves into debt to pay a smuggler.
In 2001, Barbarita's husband left Cañar for Brooklyn, New York, and soon after he asked her to join him. Once in the U.S., she realized how many other Ecuadorians had gambled so much to get there.
A bunch of us illegal immigrants would get together and discuss how much money we'd given to the smugglers and how that left our family members back in Ecuador in debt. So we started pooling together money every week. Then we would give it to any one of us who needed it the most.
That idea for a bank cooperative is what Barbarita brought back with her when she returned to Ecuador less than a year later. Today, Barbarita's counting money. She runs the Cooperativa de Ahorro y Crédito del Migrante, or the Migrant Savings and Credit Co-op, a small local bank that was created by and for migrants. By any definition, she's a success. But her face turns sad when she explains that it all came at the expense of her marriage.
It hasn't been easy. I was a very humble, responsible woman and mother.
In an indigenous, traditional Christian community like Cañar, women are expected to stay home and care for their children. But after she came back from New York, Barbarita challenged the norm, whether she intended to or not.
I loved my husband very much. I still do. But we've had so many conflicts along the way since I decided to pursue my dream to open the co-op, because I no longer just sit at home to cook and clean and iron.
Barbarita is hardly the only woman without a husband here. Driving around, you see rolling hills peppered with peasant women doing the work that was traditionally done by men, plowing, weeding, and gathering wood for charcoal. The women are also the ones managing and investing the remittance money the relatives send home. Mashi Gregorio Quispile Maloja, a local council member, says the changes brought on by migration aren't all bad.
We've been able to live a little better, to own a house and some land. I know they've been working like slaves in another country, but they and their families can live with dignity back home.
Gregorio is using some of his village's remittance money to help create new possibilities for kids here, so they don't have to go abroad. For the first time ever, the village has a public school.
We've always told the kids, those of you who have parents living abroad, you should really take advantage of this. You have to value yourselves and your education and have a vision for the future.
During school recess, kids play ball and run around. But Rosa Quispe takes it easy. Rosa's 32 and a senior in high school. Her parents migrated to New York when she was 18 and left her with an aunt and an uncle. Today, she's the single mother of a 12-year-old girl.
Sometimes I complain to my parents for not making me study when I was younger, for not supporting me when I needed them most. But now they say, go ahead, we'll support you in everything we can.
Before her parents left, Rosa used to work as a seamstress, but now her parents pay for all her expenses. She hopes to go on to college, the first in her family, and become a doctor. Rosa says she's never seriously considered leaving Cañar.
Because my parents left me. That's why I wouldn't want my daughter to go through that.
Still, despite her grief, Rosa recognizes that she wouldn't have had this chance for a better life if her parents hadn't left. Her daughter Nancy lacks for nothing. She lives in a good, clean home, has food, clothes, school supplies, and gadgets, too. But the imagined possibilities of a new life in the big city are too powerful a pull. Nancy has told her mom she wants to move to New York. Her grandparents have already promised to send the first payment for her smuggler in a few years. For Latino USA, I'm Ruxandra Guidi, Cañar, Ecuador.
Ruxandra Guidi's story was made possible by a grant from the International Reporting Project. Coming up on Latino USA...
This industry is now catching up on comic book and geek culture. It's been there, it's been the first.
Hip-hop icon DMC on what he loved even before music. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Yeah!
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumber Liquidators, supporting the Ronald McDonald House Charities, the National Braille Press, and NPR. Information at lumberliquidators.com. And the Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and developing countries. On the web at lemelson.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And we couldn't talk about taboos today without talking about drugs. As an overnight crime reporter for the Washington Post, Ruben Castañeda covered shootings, robberies, murders. He was even present when recently deceased Marion Barry, the infamous former D.C. mayor, was busted using crack cocaine in a hotel room. But Ruben had a secret of his own. He was a crack addict himself. His experiences and the stories of others affected by the 1980s crack epidemic are detailed in his book, S Street Rising. And he joins us now. Ruben, welcome to Latino USA.
Very good to be here.
So, Ruben, you came to D.C. from L.A., where you grew up, and you actually first used crack when you were in L.A. When did you realize that you were one of those people who was addicted to crack after just one try?
I never imagined that I would become an addict, somebody who couldn't stop. And in fact, I didn't use crack a second time for another 2 or 3 weeks, even though it was such a tremendous euphoric high. But I did go back and I made a buy on my own. And at that point, it became a regular part of my life. And by the time I moved to Washington, D.C., a year later to work for the Washington Post, it was an integral part of my life and something that I worked very hard to hide from other people.
What was it inside of you that just said, well, it's now when I'm going to reveal that I too was a crack addict? A lot of people might have just said, you know what, I've been there, I've done that, I'm over it, and I don't want to talk about it. What made you want to talk about it so publicly?
I guess I came out as a crack addict in an article in the Washington Post magazine that was published in December of 2007. At the time, I was assigned to Prince George's County, Maryland, where I was writing many, many stories about police brutality and other forms of corruption. And at some point in the spring of that year, I'd received an anonymous email. I'm certain it was from a county police officer who taunted me about a run-in I'd had with the LAPD about 20 years earlier. It was the sort of information that only somebody in law enforcement could have accessed with a law enforcement computer. So that made me realize that if somebody was willing to do that, which is a federal offense, what might they do if they found out that I had been hospitalized for crack addiction? So that made me realize that I should probably tell my own narrative rather than take the chance that somebody else would try to use it against me. And I just felt like there was space to write something that was true and honest.
So I have to tell you, Ruben, one of the things that actually was deeply upsetting to me as I was reading your book and actually made me angry was the whole relationship between yourself and the women who you call strawberries. And these are the women who basically would trade sex for crack. On the one hand, they were clearly central to your life in this moment when you were a crack addict. And yet, we don't really know anything about them except that on many times you think they looked pretty. They were like nameless, faceless women. And that was really hard for me. What do you think about that, about this notion that, you know, even in your book, they were just kind of women who didn't deserve a whole lot of time or attention?
Well, I did provide one passage that told the story of one of these young ladies who actually became a murder victim. I knew her by one name, but when her story and photograph came out on the front page of the Washington Post, I learned about her life, how she had been a good athlete in high school and had been well-liked, and how her parents had worried about her. I think her father had been a D.C. police officer, none of which she and I ever talked about. During our encounters, these were strictly transactional encounters where I would pick up somebody to make the buys for me. By that time, I was usually drunk, and I just wanted to get onto the street and off the street as quickly as possible. As far as going back to try to interview any of these young ladies to include in the book, I think that would have been pretty much impossible because I had nicknames and first names. I've not seen any of these individuals for probably 20 to 22 years. So I did the best I could with that, and I think I described honestly in the book that these relationships were strictly transactional in nature. It was an awful way to live, and it was really like being caught in the middle of a maelstrom, my own and that of the city, because the city was spiraling out of control with the crack cocaine trade and the violence that went with it. At the same time, my own life was spiraling out of control. They were out there trying to feed their habit. I was out there trying to feed my habit, and we interacted at that point. My intent was not to harm any of them, but looking back, yes, it was a terrible way to live. If I could see any of them today, I would tell them that I'm sorry that I behaved in the way I did. I hope that they're okay, but I have no way of knowing.
So, Ruben, you grew up in Los Angeles, in Boyle Heights, a very Latino L.A., but that meant that when you moved to Washington, D.C., you were pretty much the odd Latino out in a city that back then was pretty much, you know, focused on the black-white dynamic, with the exception of Salvadorans who were now just getting into Washington, D.C. in the mid-1980s. So how did that dynamic play into your mindset and your behavior, both as a reporter and as a crack addict?
I think there were probably fewer than five other Latinos at the Post when I got there. There might have been a couple more. I think that just added to my sense of isolation. Using alcohol and drugs in an abusive manner is a good way to isolate oneself. On some level, I knew that I was heading down a disastrous path, but I tried to keep that behavior as secret from my friends as long as I could, and my family. I compartmentalized as best I could. And being the only, you know, often the only Latino in the newsroom at a given time, you know, I'd look to my left, to my right, and, it, you know, there might be myself and one or two others. I think that did add to the sense of isolation, which was already there in a dramatic fashion because of my alcoholism and addiction. And also, when I moved to D.C., I didn't know anybody. I moved from Los Angeles. I had worked at the Herald Examiner, which was a great place to work. And all my friends and family at the time were in California. So I moved to D.C. not knowing a single individual. So, yeah, and then working the night shift when it's just a skeleton crew, that added to the sense of isolation as well.
How's your family?
Well, my family's doing fine there. I lost my father 4 years ago, so it's my mom and my siblings, and I've got nieces and a nephew and a lot of cousins, and they're all in California, and they're all doing well. And I was concerned about how they would react to my writing about some of the worst moments in my life, which they didn't know the details of. But so far, the reaction has been quite positive. My relatives, just like my friends, they're glad that I made it out, and they accept me for who I am and who I've been since they've known me.
Well, we're happy to hear that, Ruben, and we're so happy that they do still love you. Thanks so much for your work.
Thank you.
Ruben Castañeda is a former reporter for The Washington Post and author of S Street Rising, Crack, Murder, and Redemption in D.C. It used to be a big deal to like both hip-hop and rock. But when Run-DMC put out their version of Aerosmith's song Walk This Way in 1986, it was a game changer. Another taboo? Admitting to being a geek of color. But as we know, that's becoming commonplace as well. And the DMC of Run-DMC, Daryl McDaniels, is part of that story too. Latino USA producer Daisy Rosario has more.
When I was a young man growing up, you said one line and I was like, yo, this is my dude. DMC, I can draw.
Yeah.
At a panel on hip-hop and comic books at New York Comic Con, one panelist points out that DMC of Run DMC has always loved to draw.
Yeah, I caught it. Because I could have said, I'm DMC, I can rap. I'm DMC, I can rap. I said, I'm DMC, I can draw.
And was bragging about it, too.
Yeah, like, you know, DJ Russ, I'm DJ Russ, I can draw.
Like we said before, we rap hardcore. I'm DJ Run, I can scratch. I'm DMC, I can draw. And now we got the name.
Yo, yo, what's up? This is DMC and The Place to Be, a.k.a. Daryl McDaniels, the king of rock.
The Place to Be, the Latino USA studio in Harlem. See, before he was the king of rock, known to the world as the DMC in Run DMC, Daryl McDaniels was a comic book fan. And now he's created his own publishing company, Daryl Makes Comics, and is putting out his own comic book, perfectly titled DMC.
I was a kid that had my comic books, took tracing paper, and wanted to draw all the Marvel superheroes and Batman and Superman. And then by 6 years old, I think I started drawing, you know, the tracing paper thing around 5 years old. But by 6 and 7 years old, I was able to move the tracing paper and just draw. Captain America, Hulk, Marvel was my thing.
As new influences came into his life, McDaniels still saw things through the lens of comics.
Well, as a kid, you put your blanket on your neck and you pretend you're Batman and Superman. When hip-hop first came to Queens, from the Bronx and from Manhattan, all the kids wanted to be Flash, Melly Mel, and Bambada. It wasn't a showbiz thing. So all the kids wanted to get turntables. All the kids wanted to be their favorite superhero breakdancers like Rocksteady. Everything hip-hop was graffiti, DJing, MCing, the style. We wanted to be those B-boys and B-girls were our superheroes.
Comics also made him a better student.
What I learned in school, in history, World War II, come home, Captain America would take me to World War II. What I learned about science and geology and social studies, I would come home in Iron Man and the Avengers and Deathlock, you know, robotics and science. Marvel Comics would take me there.
And that wasn't the only place that Marvel Comics took him.
I lived in New York City, Queens, but I didn't get to go to Manhattan. I didn't get to go to the Bronx. Marvel Comics was cooler than DC because it would show me places in New York that I wasn't allowed to go. I was one of those kids. You be in this house when that sun going down. So I never got to go to 42nd Street or Park Avenue. Do you know the Avengers Mansion was in Central Park? You know, so Marvel took me to all these places.
The stories and the superheroes in comics also gave McDaniels his confidence.
When you think about a comic book, yeah, the Invincible Iron Man, the Incredible Hulk. When I stepped to the microphone, I didn't just become DMC. I became the devastating mic-controlling DMC.
McDaniels even remembers renaming Jam Master J. Originally, Jam Master J was going by Jazzy J, but there was already a Jazzy J, and you just can't do that.
I said, Jay, give me a minute. Went home, sat down, went into my creative comic book world and said, okay, his name is Jay. He can't be Grandmaster. The jam is a record. Hey, DJ, play my favorite jam. But the jam is also the party. Yo, man, that jam last night was great. This is comic book mind. Jay is going to be the jam master because he's the master of it all. And you got to know, I saw Jay the next day. I said, Jay, you ready? Here's your name. And he was like, what is it? Jazzy Jason. I said, no, you're going to be the jam master, Jay. He was like, wow. I am the Jam Master J. And think about it. That name was so original, so unique. But that labeling came from comic books.
The editor-in-chief of Daryl Makes Comics, or DMC's company, is experienced art director and fellow hip-hop head slash comic book geek, Edgardo Miranda Rodriguez.
When we wanted to make this comic book, hip-hop was going to be in the comic book, but it had to be organic. In fact, the word hip-hop is never even written or mentioned once in a comic book because it's just organic. Why is it organic? Because it's coming from our experience. We grew up in New York City, so organically, the story's going to feel, smell, look like hip-hop. Organically, it's also going to be culturally diverse because that was our reality. We didn't grow up in just one segmented black or Latino or Asian or white neighborhood. It was a mix.
This industry is now catching up on comic book and geek culture. It's been there. It's been diverse. The industry's also disrespectful to the capability of different people, but also our black people and Latino people to discuss, comprehend, and relate to current issues. You know what I'm saying? It's almost like, you know, when it comes to racism and poverty and stuff like that, they don't let us talk, especially if we're younger than 40 years old.
And while it may still be hard to be heard, Miranda Rodriguez thinks that now is the time for this book.
We couldn't have done this book 10 years ago or 20 years ago, and definitely not 30 years ago when Run DMC first came out. We need to make this book now. Not saying we live in a new race-conscious America just because we have an African-American president. No. I feel like right now America is like a buffet. I think for the longest, we've been kind of like, America's been more like a TV dinner under aluminum foil. When we unwrap it, we see what's actually for dinner. But now America is becoming more of a buffet. When you walk into the dining hall, you see everything, the good and the bad.
Daryl DMC McDaniels hopes that through this book, he can do for another generation what the arts did for him.
Hip-hop didn't start with rappers alike. But before it was on a record, there was a whole era of creativity that was going on. And that era, that creativity, the pop culture of comic books, kung fu movies, and hip-hop was powerful enough to inspire and educate a young Catholic school kid. And it changed my life.
For Latino USA, I'm Daisy Rosario.
I'm the king of rap. There is none higher. Sucker MCs should call me sire. To burn my kingdom, you must choose fire. I won't stop rocking till I retire.
The comic book DMC is available now. For more information, check out our website at latinousa.org. And other rappers can't stand us, but give us respect.
Like who for cool in the game?
Roll to the rock, rock to the roll. DMC stands for devastated mind control. You can't touch me with a 10-foot pole. And I even made the devil sell me his soul. Now we crash through walls, come through floors, bust through ceilings, knock down doors. And when we're on the tape, we're fresh out the box. You can hear our sound. Four blocks and blocks. For every living person, a verbal trick. It's me and DMC.
Coming up on Latino USA.
I, as a white woman, walk into a classroom full of almost exclusively non-white students, and like that sends messages before I even open my mouth.
The awkward and even painful conversations about race in the classroom. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems, at pewtrusts.org.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Almost half of American public school students are kids of color, but more than 80% of their teachers are white. That's according to the Center for American Progress. So are the country's teachers prepared to teach students of color? And why is it such a taboo for educators to talk about race? Reporter Yo-Wei Shaw has more from Philadelphia.
Victor Jackson is over writing about U.S. presidents, especially the slave owner Thomas Jefferson. So when Victor's seventh grade teacher asked him to write about a president, he said no.
I was like, if I write this paper, you're going to be upset.
Instead, he asked his teacher if he could write about Huey Newton.
And she's asking me, who is Huey Newton? I was like...
Victor told her he helped found the Black Panther Party.
And she was just like, is that like a basketball team?
Victor ended up not writing about either Thomas Jefferson or Huey Newton.
She changed the assignment and we wrote about pierogies.
Pierogies, as in the Eastern European dumplings. Imani Rothwell also has stories.
In sixth grade, during Black History Month, I had this teacher, and we were on the topic of slavery. And she tried to paint it as this thing that just happened. It's like, oh, slavery happened, but let's move on. And I was like, no, that's not how we're going to do it. And then she had the nerve to ask me, was I raised by wolves? Because I decided to correct her.
Imani walked out of the classroom and got a detention.
How many times have you been kicked out or disciplined for disagreeing with teachers over race?
Sadly, I can't even count.
Imani's a tough cookie, but even she would break at times.
I wouldn't deny that. Late at night, I would cry because I felt so frustrated. You know how you feel you can't do anything when you feel powerless? I think it's the worst feeling in the world.
Some students say their teachers stereotype them, misinterpret their culture, or completely avoid the subject of race. This year, the U.S. Department of Education's Civil Rights Office reported that students of color face a disproportionate number of suspensions and expulsions.
Well, I think when students feel that they're not a part of the classroom, and in fact that it is openly hostile to them, then they do a couple things. They can either withdraw so they just don't participate, or they act out.
That's Gloria Ladson-Billings at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. For years, she's been fighting to make classrooms more culturally relevant. She even coined the term. Ladson-Billings says that typically, teacher prep programs only require one cultural competency course, and that teacher educators are overwhelmingly white. But the point isn't to blame teachers.
Remember that teachers are not outside of the society. They receive the same messages we all receive via media, via their own, quote, experiences or lack thereof. So they are doing their best to, quote, catch up with some stuff.
In Philadelphia, a grassroots organization called Teacher Action Group is trying to do just that. Like here at John P. Stetson Charter School.
I'm really glad Mr. Wilson's here. He didn't read the readings, but that's okay.
A group of teachers meets every 2 weeks to discuss the teacher education book, Rethinking Multicultural Education. Fifth grade teacher Elizabeth Kim says the book club is a safe space.
So when you're talking about race and when you only have like your story or like, you know, the stories of people around you to base your knowledge off of, then it becomes very scary to like open it up to questions that might make you squirm. But you have to be okay with that.
The teachers talk about how to handle sensitive topics like the legacy of Christopher Columbus, the aftermath of the Michael Brown shooting in Ferguson, Missouri, or how to be aware of their own biases.
I, as a white woman, walk into a classroom full of almost exclusively non-white students, and like that sends messages before I even open my mouth.
That's seventh grade teacher Jamie Stevenson. She says there's no easy formula, But what's most important is understanding her students.
What their cultural background is, who they are as people interacting with one another in the world.
When a teacher finally did that with Imani Rothwell, it was huge.
I said to her, are you one of those teachers who teach Black history during Black History Month? She said, no, a real history teacher teach Black history all year round. And when she said that, I said, you are amazing. For the first time in middle school, I love going to history, and I didn't fear that this might be the day I get kicked out of class.
For Latino USA, I'm Yoe Shaw.
This story was produced as part of Raise Up, a project of Youth Speaks in collaboration with AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio. Writer Daisy Hernandez is no stranger to subjects people don't want to talk about. Her memoir, A Cup of Water Under My Bed, delves into a lot of dangerous territory. Daisy grew up in New Jersey. She's the daughter of a Colombian mother and a Cuban father. When she was a teenager, she got her first job after school working at McDonald's.
I finally have money, so I want to buy all the stuff that my mother's not buying me, like the really expensive lipstick and the eyeshadows and the clothing and pretty much every desire that I feel has been denied to me my whole youth. A manager there actually approached me and said, hey, I've got a proposition for you. And she showed me how I could basically take an order but not ring the order up and still keep people their change. So what's going to happen is the register is going to end up having more money than what it shows that it should have, right? And she said, I'll give you a cut at the end. And I didn't understand exactly, like, oh, I'm stealing or doing something bad, because I was 15 and she was cool and I wanted her to really like me. And I look back now and I think, oh my God, like, I could have ended up, you know, in juvie at 15. And it was really just like plain stupidity. It wasn't even like, I know I'm doing something evil and I have chosen it. It was like, I am just a dumb kid. And at the end of the night, she gives me something like $300. But then I get to college and I discover, you don't have to steal, you can get a credit card. And they'll just give it to you. And I had only ever seen credit cards, I think, on TV or not even films, TV shows. No one in my family had a credit card. My dad and my mom really believed, you know, nada de deudas. You know, you just don't owe money. That the worst thing that could ever happen to you was owing money. But I am their U.S.-born daughter. I believe owing people money is fine. And I go out and the first thing I do is buy $100 pair of shoes. And my poor mother is looking at my feet like, ¿cuánto costó? $100? Like, she just couldn't imagine that you could spend that much money on a pair of shoes. But this is the 90s. It's the hip-hop era. Everybody has Timberlands. These are the cool shoes that everyone else has. And so, again, it's sort of me wanting to fit in just like anyone else. Coming from a working class family where you did have to be conscientious about cada centavo that was coming in, this idea that we know we're not really middle class, but we feel like we can buy into that life and buy into that lifestyle. And for me, it did get out of control. For me, everything started being paid for with a credit card here and there and here and there. I had consolidated, you know, you consolidate the credit cards. So I'm sending them these huge checks every month. But in my brain, it does not compute that if I'm sending them $300, but I'm still using the credit card and charging $500 a month, I'm still going to owe money more and more. So I ended up going to the support group. And the first thing that they tell you is you have to cut up all the credit cards. And I said, no way, but I will put them in the freezer so that way I can slow down. You know, it's like an alcoholic. And then after 4 years of not using those credit cards, I was very tempted, or thought I would be tempted. My debt was significantly reduced. I was definitely living within my means. My feelings about money and my identity as a Latina had dramatically changed. I had to then unravel a lot of the feelings that would come up because, okay, then I'm in a situation where, I have a fiesta to go to, and no, I can't buy the super expensive bottle of wine for my host because I don't have that money, so now I'm going to get the cheaper bottle of wine. I feel like a a loser showing up with that cheaper wine, all of a sudden feeling like I'm going to be the only Latina at this white party with her cheap booze or what it could have been some other gift, you know? And I realized, oh, yeah, there's this way in which as Latina in a predominantly white professional world, I'm constantly feeling like I have to prove myself. And so as I stopped using credit cards and started to just feel those feelings and realize, wait a minute, my money has nothing to do with my self-worth. It has nothing to do with my sense of being a Latina or my adequacy to do a job or to be a good friend or any of this stuff. I started to feel better about myself. And so I knew I didn't need the credit card.
Daisy may have stopped feeling like her identity depended on money, but she still had doubts when it came to her professional life. She was interning at her dream publication, the New York Times. But her experience made her question the morals behind what many consider the most respected institution in the news business.
It was the spring of 2003, and there was a young reporter by the name of Jason Blair at the New York Times. I was there as a reporting intern, and which was exactly how he had started at the newspaper, too. So Jason Blair was someone that presumably I was supposed to be aspiring to be. But in the spring of 2003, it became really clear that he was actually plagiarizing stories. He was stealing stories. The head editor, Howell Raines at the time, was blamed for playing favorites with Jason Blair because Jason Blair is a black man. The racial anxieties that people might have been trying to keep behind a closed door suddenly were able to come out. And the story became, you know, he only got as far as he did because he's black. This would have never happened with a white reporter. You know, as a good friend of mine says, you know, when white people get anxious, they call a meeting. they want to do something. And so there was a huge town hall meeting with where all New York Times employees were invited to attend. And so we're in this theater. It's hundreds of people. It's extremely uncomfortable. Howell Raines actually admitted to the group something along the lines of saying, you know, you all have a right to ask if I played favorites, if I had too much sympathy for Jason Blair, you know, and he acknowledged, you know, as a white man from the South, you know, we do take stances about race, right? And I remember just sitting in the audience just being like, don't go there, don't go there. I just knew that the people in this audience were not going to be sympathetic to him. They were so angry. They felt that their institution had been betrayed. And for me personally, I felt like they were really, really angry that a young black man had received certain opportunities. And then he admitted, you know, I think I did give him too many chances because of race. And those weren't his exact words, but there was something to that effect. There was an idea that the scandal was this young black man plagiarizing the stories. And absolutely, that is a scandal. But it's not a scandal that this newsroom does not look like the rest of the city. This is not a multiracial newsroom like the rest of the city. This is an incredibly white newsroom of reporters and editors. There were very few of us as people of color at that time. And that is not a scandal, you know? And no one talks about that, right?
Daisy talks about a whole lot of other interesting topics in her memoir. The book is called A Cup of Water Under My Bed. And you can find a link to Daisy Hernandez's website on our site, latinousa.org. And finally, as always, we bring you some sabiduría, or words of wisdom. This week, writer April Salazar tells us a story about speaking with her father about one of the most taboo topics of all.
My dad's a conservative Mexican-American, and by mutual agreement, neither one of us would ever acknowledge that I have a sex life. So when I started fertility treatments, it seemed like the best of both worlds. I got to tell him that he was going to be a grandfather again, and even better, that I was going to conceive said grandchild immaculately. Unfortunately, the first round of fertility treatments wasn't successful, nor the second, nor the third, nor the fourth. When, after the eighth try, I finally got a positive pregnancy test, I couldn't wait to share the news with Dad. He was so excited that he blurted out, "Good, I hope he's a boy so that I can teach him how to cuss." "Dad," I said, "you can teach a girl to f***ing cuss too." I found out a few weeks later that I was expecting a boy. My husband and I got the bad news in the second trimester. The baby had a birth defect, lethal skeletal dysplasia. Because his chest was too small, he would suffocate within hours, if not minutes, of birth, and I was given a choice. I could carry my baby to term, or I could terminate the pregnancy. I couldn't bear the thought of giving birth to my child only to watch him suffer and die. I called my father in California with the bad news. He arrived in Brooklyn, where I live, the next day. Dad pretended not to see my swollen belly, and we avoided all talk of the baby. It was just too painful, but I broke the ice the next day. If the test comes back positive, I think I'm going to terminate. I was so nervous about how he was going to react. I had attended my first pro-choice march when I was 12, but I knew that my father felt differently about abortion, and I knew how much he was looking forward to meeting this little boy. But more than that, I was still my father's little girl, and I needed his love and approval. Dad was silent for what seemed like a long time. Then he said, "You know, you're my daughter, and I would support you no matter what." Dad called me the night before I terminated to check in on me and to tell me that he loved me. I told him that I didn't know how I was going to do it. And he said, "You will surprise yourself. You'll find that you have wells of strength that you didn't even know you had." That was a year and a half ago. Since then, I've had a baby girl, a healthy baby girl. I hope that she'll feel like she can talk to me about anything, and I hope that I can listen with an open mind and an open heart, just as my father listened to me.
April Salazar is a writer and storyteller living in Brooklyn. April terminated her pregnancy at 21 weeks. Recently, there's been a push in state legislatures to adopt bans on abortion at 20 weeks. 9 states currently restrict 20-week abortions, and several others are considering similar bans. Republicans have promised to propose a national 20-week ban in the Senate next year once they control the chamber. A ban has already been passed in the House of Representatives. Thanks for listening today, mis queridos. That's it for this week. But before we go, we want to take a moment to remember Juan Flores. He's the co-founder of the Afro-Latino Forum and a professor of Latino studies at NYU. Gracias, Juan. Your work will live on in your students and in the Latino community. And thank you for raising up the voices of Afro-Latinos and Latinas in the U.S. Pa'lante, Juan. Siempre pa'lante. Latino USA is produced by A.C. Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Camilo Vargas, and Antonia Cerejido. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our interns are Julia Shu and Laura Calzada. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. And I'll see you on my Instagram. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all. The Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. And the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the strengthening of international peace and security at carnegie.org. Funding for Latino USA's coverage of a culture of health is made possible in part by a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
Sí, it's very nice. It's very, very, hay mucho canto.
Exactly. Como no, no, nunca se preocupan de mucho.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Inada, maker of the DreamWave massage chair, Japanese crafted with shiatsu point detection, and 16 pre-programmed massages, including morning, night, and full body sessions. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working together to build a culture of health for all. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.